Hello, my name is Rainer Hirsch. I am a conductor and comedian, and welcome to my pop-up podcast about the proms, Proms in the Pub. Well, I have watched one prom on TV, sat in a posh seat, well, a seat, and last Thursday was my day to finally get stuck into this year's Promenade concerts and stand in the arena of the Albert Hall. Arena, good name for it. Like the Roman amphitheatres of old, the Albert Hall's arena is the big flat area at the bottom where gladiators would have had their vengeance in this life or the next. It's the natural focus of the venue where, in truth, the orchestra really should be, except they'd have their back to half the audience, but isn't, and beneath whose sticky carpet, according to legend, lies buried one of Adolf Hitler's testicles. Just £6 to get into the arena, tickets only available on the day. It's what the Promenade concerts are named after, and what guarantees anyone who performs on the stage a standing ovation, by definition. Well, I'll tell you one thing that has changed in the arena since I was last there. There's no more throwing your money down on a counter and passing through turnstiles like at the football. There's not even contact payment with debit. Who am I kidding? Credit card. That was something of a surprise to me as I bowled up, ticketless, with just 15 minutes until showtime to be told that tickets are now online only. So the countdown ticking, I started feverishly tapping away on my mobile phone, and that's all going quite well until I come to the payment stage. Enter debit, credit, card details. Ah, I don't actually have my physical card with me. These days, contact payment and everything, I haven't actually seen my credit card for months. It slowly dawns on me that I must in fact resign myself to a promised trudge back to Hirsch Mansions. Then, right on cue, appears my guardian angel in the form of Wendy. Wendy, a gentle lady from Torquay in Devon, who is at the concert with her husband and daughter, and someone in their party hasn't turned up. Would I like the ticket? Free? Gratis? No strings attached? Salvation. I gratefully accept and enjoy the concert from a lovely seat down in the stalls, chatting in the interval to Wendy and her husband, Mike. They politely turned down my offer of a gin and tonic in the interval, which at £10.25 a pop gave me cause to breathe a sigh of relief. Prices there remind me of a joke. Man goes into the Albert Hall bar. I'd like 2 pints of beer and a packet of crisps, but I'm sorry, I've only got a £50 note. Barman, well, you'll have to put the bag of crisps back then, won't you? Regardless, Wendy and Mike reminded me of the great community of promenaders. A feeling that we're all somehow in it together and someone standing outside the Albert Hall looking a bit frazzled is worthy of aid. Thank you again, Wendy and Mike. Why all this effort? Well, because Thursday's concert featured a world premiere by British composer Sally Beamish called Hive, a four-movement harp concerto in all but name. It was essentially The Four Seasons by Vivaldi, but for bees. Sally Beamish has done other insect pieces, actually. Beetles, flies, which is a bit like me, actually. I once trained a mosquito to play the minute waltz. See? I liked Hive a lot, and the harp soloist, Catherine Finch, even more. Gold sequin jacket, peroxide white hair, red plimsolls, deep unapologetic bow to the audience before she began. In the applause afterwards, she and the French conductor, Aria Matiak, were joined on stage by Hive composer Sally Beamish. Three women acknowledging the, by definition, standing ovation, not a stiff bow tie between them. Worth the price of the ticket on its own, if I'd paid it. Now, if you've been listening to other episodes in this podcast, you'll know that The Proms is actually presented by the BBC, which we at Proms and the Pub are nothing to do with. But the reason why I'm speaking like this is the announcers on BBC Radio generally speak like this. We interrupt this programme to tell you that thermonuclear war has broken out. Missiles will be creating a fireball from which there is no escape in 3 minutes. Which leaves us just enough time to hear this charming pair of Elizabethan dances played on the theorbo. Though we're nothing to do with the BBC, I've often thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could get a tame Radio 3 presenter to talk to us about what the Proms is like from their perspective? Well, we've hit the jackpot. Rob Cowan has previously worked for both Radio 3 and Classic FM, the alternative radio station. He's an absolute mine of information about performers and recordings, and after all these years, he's still as curious as ever. You have been writing about classical music for well over 50 years, Rob. Can you tell me about the first time you ever went to the proms?
I think I first went to the proms in the 1960s, and I actually heard them on the radio, various. I think Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, because I'm a great Bartok freak, and one night I heard this music, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, but I wasn't quite sure what it was about. You know, Sibelius' Fifth Symphony had exactly the same effect on me. I remember going to my mother and said, you know, Mum, this music is fascinating, but I don't understand a note of it. And I remember what she said to me. She said, Rob, she said, it's very good that you admit to yourself that you don't understand a note to it, because a note of it, because that way you'll be able to develop a proper taste and be honest and not be hypocritical about it. I worked on the proms. I worked for the BBC, first of all, back in the late 1960s in concert management. And I was working on the proms there. And I'll never forget, you know, because I was quite early into Mahler. I loved Mahler. And I remember Leonard Bernstein's recording of Mahler's Seventh Symphony had just been released. And I got it out of the library. I couldn't afford the LPs, but I got it out of the library. And I was bowled over by this music. And I remember Derek Cook, who was in the next office, had reviewed the recording for Gramophone. You know, I was fascinated to talk to him about it, because I was, you know, I wasn't shy or anything about approaching him. And I said, hey, Mr. Cook, you know, I was fascinated by this aspect, that aspect. We said, oh, Rob, he said, you can't experience Mahler 7 without hearing it live. Yeah, recordings are all well and good, and that Bernstein recording is terrific, but you've got to hear the piece live. So, as it just so happens, Yasha Horenstein was conducting, I think it was the BBC Symphony Orchestra, in a performance a couple of nights later, and I went. Do you know what? I went straight back to my records, because I don't know whether it was the Albert Hall, because I think this was pre-saucers, flying saucers up in the roof.
That was a 68 or something.
Yeah, so I heard three performances of Mahler 7, actually, all at the same time. And I thought, no, this sounds rubbish. And I went back and I played my Bernstein recording, which had been brilliantly engineered by CBS, or Sony Classical as they are then. And the performance was fantastic, which, to be absolutely honest, look, Horenstein's a very distinguished conductor, but his performance wasn't fantastic, and it didn't make as much of an impression as the records had made.
Hey, now, in a previous episode of this past podcast, by the way, you know that Mahler 7 is actually at the proms. The Berlin Philharmonic are doing two concerts in early September. The first one is Mahler 7. The second one is Shostakovich 10. And in an earlier edition of this podcast, I completely dissed Mahler 7 because I say I couldn't stand it. Tell me what should I be listening for in Mahler 7? For me, it's just long and mysterious and with no good tunes.
Well, I'll tell you what's wonderful about it. The scherzo's fabulous, because it's a sort of things that go bump in the night type scherzo. It's wonderful. And what I love about Mahler 7 is when it starts, it sort of ambles into action. And it's like he's getting up out of bed, and then he thinks, oh, goodness, I don't want to know. And he gets back into bed again. And it's a sort of stream of consciousness piece. This is what I love about Mahler 7. It's pure invention. There's none of the neurosis you get in some of the other symphonies. The Ninth is an absolute masterpiece. Das Lied von der Erde is an absolute masterpiece. But the Seventh is honest music. It's Mahler being Mahler and not allowing anything to get in his way. And the two Nachtmusik movements are wonderful. You know, one of them's got a tango, one of them's got a motor oil advertisement in it, which you'll recognise when you hear it. You know, the finale, I think your guest, I think it was
Ivan Hewitt. Ivan also, he said two things about it. One is he found it the hardest to get into, that, you know, the opening theme of the last movement is so banal he can't believe anybody wasted their time on it. And he also said that conductors, Esa-Pekka Salonen, for example, have admitted to him that it was the hardest one of the set. You know, they find it hardest to make any sense of.
And the reason I feel that that's the case is that it hasn't got the, it doesn't have a route to the emotions in the way the others do. You know, it's very abstract music. It's halfway to Schoenberg and Berg and Webern and that sort of music. It's very prophetic of composers that were coming in the early 20th century or, you know, later on in the 20th century. And the Tunach music movements, I mentioned those, and that wonderful scherzo in the middle, but the most incredible movement, which is rubbish really, is the finale, which Ivan said, I say rubbish, I mean it's fun because it quotes, I think, Mendelssohn and the Merry Widow and all sorts of things. But I'll tell you something, Rainer, if I heard Mahler 7 without knowing anything about it, and I heard that finale, I would swear blind that somebody had come along and completed the symphony. Not Mahler. That was somebody, you know, Joe Bloggs had written a finale because Mahler never completed it. But
the publishers lost the manuscript.
It's Kirill Petrenko who's conducting the Berlin Phil. There's a recording with him conducting the Bavarian State Orchestra, which is absolutely wonderful. And Petrenko, for me, there are two conductors on the scene at the moment who are absolutely up there with the best. Petrenko is certainly one of them. And I reckon that's going to be a problem. That's certainly going to be one I'll listen to, no doubt about that.
Well, do you know what? I see, I'm making an effort to go to concerts, but I'm going to have to kill for a ticket because that, of course, both Berlin... Actually, no, that concert is sold out. The second one, which I am going to, isn't sold out. So I'm going to have to, you know, start very early in the morning. The second one is Schnitka Viola Concerto and Shostakovich 10th Symphony.
I'll tell you something about the 10th Symphony and the Proms. Have you got time to listen?
Let's do the whole thing. I hope you've got time to tell.
Well, the most memorable prom I ever went to, and it's been described as the most memorable prom ever, was the one in August 1968 when the Russians entered Prague. Now, most famously, Rostropovich played Dvorak's cello concerto with the USSR State Symphony Orchestra under Yevgeny Svetlanov. Everybody was moved. There were people demonstrating outside the Albert Hall, shouting and screaming, Russians go home, and all that sort of stuff. But he gave a pretty terrific performance. Anyway, they did the Dvorak. Rostropovich did an encore, which was one of the Sarabands from a Bach cello suite, from one of the Bach cello suites of Sarabande, tears streaming down his face while he was... playing. It was incredibly moving. But don't run away, because it was Rostropovich, thinking that that was the highlight. Rostropovich playing a Czech work, and Czechoslovakia had been invaded, and all the sort of emotional stuff there, which of course was tragic and terrible. But the real highlight was in the second half, which was Shostakovich's 10th Symphony, conducted by Svetlanov, which has come out on a disc, not in very good sound, but it was electrifying, electrifying. So Petrenko is going to have to go some with the Berlin Philharmonic to beat Svetlanov and his USSR State Symphony Orchestra. Another Shostakovich work that I would love to recommend you try, if you don't know it, is the Last Symphony, the 15th Symphony, which is like eavesdropping on his attitude towards death. It's got sort of ticking clocks or percussion that sound like ticking clocks going at various places. You know, quotes from William Tell and Wagner's Götterdämmerung. It's terrifying. And I will never forget the first British performance. It was on a Sunday morning, and I sat in my bedroom at home because I was very young. I was still living at home, listening to this work, and I found it so exciting and gripping and frightening. It is a frightening piece, so I definitely recommend you listen to that one as well. Wonderful composer.
Do you think that Svetlanov, that was possibly the greatest Proms performance ever? Can you think of other greats from the time that you've been either listening or being involved in it? What are the great historical appearances?
Well, you know, Maurits Janssens, the conductor, well, his father was a conductor called Arvids Janssens, and he appeared with what was then the Leningrad Philharmonic Orchestra, before it became the St. Petersburg Philharmonic, before the fall of communism. And he did the Tchaikovsky Fifth, which was very much along the lines of Ravinsky, you know, tearing along in the fast lane in the last movement. Fantastic. I think that, because I presented quite a lot of the Proms for the BBC in the noughties, and one that I was particularly taken with was Vaughan Williams's Ninth Symphony with Andrew Davis conducting. That was a wonderful performance, and I felt myself privileged to present it, because it's not a work that I know terribly well. I certainly didn't know it terribly well then, and I found it extremely moving. And there are the Last Nights, you know. I presented two Last Nights with Stephanie Hughes, who was absolutely lovely, and they were great fun. You cannot believe what it's like being in that little box in that hall, which is absolutely packed, and with flags and colours of all sorts, and people wearing all sorts of daft hats and jackets and everything. It is absolutely exciting. And in that box, you feel like the Queen addressing the crowds. It's absolutely wonderful. So I did two of those during my stay at Radio 3, and I loved doing them, really enjoyed them.
We imagine that little box is pretty, like hermetically sealed. Well, obviously, it's soundproof, because that's what you want. I mean, can you swing a cat? What's inside?
Well, it's dead simple, actually. It's a bit like flying a tiger moth. You know, I mean, it's just a few controls. There's the microphone, obviously, and the switch here and a switch there. Not sophisticated at all. The guy who does all the work, as far as the technical side is concerned, is in the box, the glass box behind you, and he will say, you know, come in here and come in there. I remember the first one I did was Mahler Fifth Symphony with Simon Rattle and the Berlin Philharmonic, and I was having a whale of a time. And of course, there was before the Mahler came on, there was a very long break, a long break, so all the instruments could get together and get repositioned and everything like that. And I'd been to the rehearsal, and I made a note of all the things I wanted to say. And I was going hell for leather saying all these things. And somebody wrote into the message board the next day saying that, who does Rob Keller think he is? He sounded just like a racehorse commentator because I was going so fast. But, you know, I calmed down a little bit after that. But I did enjoy doing those Proms, and the interviews also with artists and meeting artists in the back of the, down in the basement as well.
That's interesting. Where are you on the Albert Hall as a venue, just as a listening experience? When you're in the box, of course, you are presumably getting the recorded sound, the microphone sound, because you're in your box. But when you're sitting in the audience, you know, how is that as an experience for listening to great music?
It's okay. It depends on the music you're hearing. If it's a big, mightily scored orchestral work then it's going to be impressive with heavy percussion, heavy brass. If it's delicate music, then maybe it gets a little bit lost. It depends who's playing as well. Now, the piano can sometimes be a bit clangorous, but it's okay. I don't mind it. I mean, I prefer the Barbican and the Royal Festival Hall, though they're not ideal either for different reasons. But the Albert Hall embraces you in the way that those halls don't.
Yeah, I actually, in my early days, I just discovered the Brahms piano concertos, and I went to see Alfred Brendel play the first piano concerto at the Proms, and I was so disappointed. It was like you and your experience with Mahler 7th Symphony. I just, you know, this thunderous, great, you know, magnificent sound, the imperiousness of that concerto, and there was none of it. It was like somebody playing the piano in the next room.
Well, I went to hear Rubinstein play that concerto with Colin Davis conducting. And the worst thing about that, it was the noisiest audience I've ever heard in all my life. In fact, very occasionally you could hear the music above the audience. And believe me, you know Brahms' first piano concerto. It takes some to drown that out with audience noise. But they managed quite well, actually.
What don't you like about, you know, what don't you want from a presenter on the radio, somebody introducing the Proms, for example?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of great presenters at Radio 3. There really are, and I loved working with them. And I suppose the only thing that I don't like is if somebody is insincere or they're trying to be so jolly and so enthusiastic that you begin to suspect the sincerity of what they're saying. I'm not saying that that's a common thing with Radio 3. I don't think it is any more than it is with Classic FM, although it does happen there as well. But really, you know, sometimes producers say sort of up, 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 come on, enthusiasm, enthusiasm, get it across. And I think, oh God, give us a break. You know, I don't need to be that hyper. What I need to do is tell people what I think of the music and what I think they might be listening out for, if they need to be told. They don't need to be told, but they might welcome the guidance, rather than pressurise or pressure listeners into following the sort of pictorial or biographical or narrative aspects of the music that you're trying to get across. I'm not there to convince people that they must listen to what I'm telling them to listen out for. I'm there to guide them. Guidance is the major thing. And some presenters are better at it than others. And there are still loads of really good presenters on Radio 3. And there are some on Classic FM. I can't say I like all of them, but I definitely do like some. And I mean, I've got no experience of Scala, very, very little, so I can't comment on that station. But I think it's a very important thing to pitch what you're saying in the right way. Try and think about what you're saying. You know, maybe the best thing, as I said, what Richard Osborne had said to me about being glad I have a script and glad I don't look at it. I think the thing is to think carefully about what you're saying, weighing up your words. That's very important, I think.
Yeah, there is a slight, you know, when you talk about being up and come on energy and all that, that's what strikes me about the TV broadcast. Sometimes it's, you know, it tends to be a little bit too happy, smiley. Maybe because they think that they're talking to people who don't, you know, don't listen so often, and they have to make it more entertainment, if you see what I mean.
Sometimes it is entertainment. Sometimes it's got there's a story to be told, and you tell that story as eloquently and as honestly as you can. I'll never forget, there was a performance by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra of Death and Transfiguration by Richard Strauss. and I was presenting it on the radio, and I worked very hard because it was a time of the Holocaust Memorial Day, and I thought Vienna, which was generally considered to be worse than Berlin when it came to the anti-Semitism and death and transfiguration, the whole idea of transfiguration. And I can't remember what I wrote, but I did an introduction to this piece which referenced the Holocaust and referenced, you know, coming out the other end and the idea of forgiveness and all these things. And I got the most beautiful email from one of the listeners who had latched on to what I'd said and really, really appreciated it. And very occasionally, you will introduce something. And another was a historic performance of Ma Vlast, My Fatherland, a Czech masterpiece by Smetana, done just after the Nazis had entered Prague. And the audience had gone berserk. It's six tone poems after each piece. And at the very end, which is, it was the last piece called Blahnik, which I played on one of my programs, and I described what happened at the very end. There's cheers and cheers. It's like a Wembley football crowd. You never heard anything like it. And suddenly the audience breaks into the Czech national anthem. I had emails of people who had to draw onto the hard shoulder because they were in tears, because it affected them so much. Now, if you play music and recordings that affect people's lives in that way, I did another one just after 9/11. I did a late night, all through the night program on the World Service. You know, that's what I'm after, is playing music, very often great music, by composers who have a hotline to your heart at times when people near to need to hear it.
Yeah, sorry, that Marvelast performance, was that was a recording you were playing, a specific recording?
It was, in fact, the Czech Philharmonic themselves put it out, and it was a recording and from 1939, and I heard it. A friend of mine put me onto it. And I was so overwhelmed by it, I got onto Supraphon, the Czech national record label, or CD label, and I said, you've got to issue this. And they did issue it, and it got a gramophone award when it came out. It's a fantastic performance. I think you can still get it. That was a few years ago. Václav Talik is the conductor, and he was the conductor of the orchestra at the time. But, you know, it's all these things which have these associations, which if you explain to people, they latch on to what you're saying and they latch on to what they're hearing because of what you've said. And I think that is incredibly important.
In terms of the proms, clearly, you know, since the BBC started broadcasting the whole concert and was able to record it, there have been recordings of every single concert. But it's surprising how few of those concerts have made it to commercial recordings. Really, you can look and it's, you know, it's in the tens as compared to the, you know, tens of thousands probably by now concerts that there have been. Why is that, do you think?
Well, actually, I thought you said it's in the Thames, and I thought that's more accurate.
That's what happens to all CDs. They get whizzed into the Thames like Odd Job from Goldfinger.
Because I was at the BBC, and the powers that be, when I was at the BBC, the philosophy there was, if you were at home and you taped for your own entertainment a prom, you did it on pain of death. And so, you know, people did tape things. And now, you know, people are actually relying on these enthusiastic amateurs who made recordings going back to the 1950s, the Rostropovich Dvorak Cello Concerto that I referred to before and the Shostakovich 10th Symphony are examples of recordings that the BBC, as far as I recall, didn't have in their archive.
So when you say when they said they did it on pain of death, basically it was illegal to record.
That's
the
right.
Concert.
That's right.
But the fact is now the BBC searches their, you know, their warehouses and find that these things, it's only those people that have got them, basically.
That it's the people who have actually got a tape that they've taken off air from all the different stations. But the BBC was particularly fussy about it. But unfortunately, I mean, you know, the Americans aren't anywhere near as fussy. And hence the fact that great recordings by Toscanini, Stokowski, broadcasts were regularly being recorded by amateurs and are out there. But fantastic performances.
The BBC hasn't kind of released many of the recordings itself, which is a bit surprising. I mean, given that...
Well, they have. They have. There's a label called ICA. There was BBC Classics before them. They have issued recordings. And, you know, instances like the Shostakovich Dvorak concert, where the sound isn't terribly good because you're relying on an amateur who was sent in a cassette. That's normally what they are. No, the BBC did tape, you know, goodness gracious, they taped virtually all the Hancock's half hours and in terrifically good sound. I'm a great Hancock fan and I've got quite a few of the CDs here. But with music, it was hit or miss, to be honest. I've got a lot of recordings that come from the BBC, but the Europeans are better. The Germans are absolutely fantastic. The WDR, SWR stations have got wonderful archives in wonderful sound, and those labels or labels that issue their recordings can reissue them cleaned up, and they sound almost like mono recordings from the same era that were made in the studio, and they're often fantastic performances featuring great artists of the past. I think the Europeans, frankly, are better at it than we are, or have been, not necessarily now. Now I think we're more conscientious about it.
Well, one final thing. What is the spirit of the Proms, just as a final conclusion?
It's a spirit of celebration. That's the thing. You go into the Proms and you connect with loads and loads of people who are there because they love music, because they love the business of listening, because it's fun, because people relate to each other. They sit and they picnic as they're queuing round the hall to get into the arena. It's a beautiful experience, and you know, there aren't many places in the world that latch on to classical music that can do it in such a wonderful way and such a celebratory way, and that is the spirit of the Proms. It makes great art seem greater still because of the zeal and enthusiasm of the people who are attending it.
Rob Cowan, what a nice man and what a great voice. He's like the trusted advisor, somebody can tell you what to listen out for. Thanks again. Incidentally, that piece he talked about, the piece by Smetana called Mavlast, recorded in Prague in 1939, just after the Nazis had invaded, is available on YouTube in its entirety. It's really worth listening. Just approximate the spelling of Vaclav Talich, Smetana, and the YouTube search engine will do its magic and come up with the recording. Now, the concert I mentioned at the beginning, the one with the B harp concerto in it, actually began with Scheherazade in a version by Ravel and ended with the famous Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov. It's the kind of piece that you feel you've somehow heard before, even if you've never heard it before. Can I be absolutely honest though? I've never really liked Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade. As a child, I found the opening tune scary and the rest of it just too bitty. Maybe those tunes could be joined together to make something all a bit snappier. Well, that's something I put to Harry, our resident special guest, and this is what he came up with. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and share, or you can get in touch with us at www.promsinthepub.co.uk. See you next time.